Okay, welcome everybody to what's the last seminar in our series of the CRASH Research Network on Subaltern and Decolonial Citizenships. It's been a really interesting, diverse, fascinating series, I think, as one of the co-conveners together with my colleague Sarah Radcliffe. And we're delighted to end with Jelke Bursten, who is a professor at King's College London. Jelke is, well, she's published actually on multiple kind of topics associated really with gender and development, and also kind of transitional justice and violence, specifically with a focus on Peru mostly, but also with some work on East Africa. So her book in 2010 was called Intersecting Inequalities, Women and Social Policy in Peru. And I'm just looking at the website, and in 2014 she published Sexual Violence During War and Peace, Gender, Power and Post-Conflict Justice in Peru. Both of those books have come out in Spanish translation, which I want to note and consider to be really important that she made that happen. In just last month, her latest book has come out, and that's called Gender, Transitional Justice and Memorial Arts: Global Perspectives on Commemoration and Mobilization, which has come out with Routledge Transitional Justice Series and is co-edited with Helen Scanlon. So, as I said, Jelke's worked on transformative gender justice in post-conflict societies. But today, she's going to be talking to us about one of the most important contemporary issues, in my view, which is abortion rights in Latin America. So I will just hand over to Jelke and invite you to talk. Thanks very much for coming to speak.
Thank you so much, Sean and Sarah and everybody for joining us on this very sunny afternoon. So I'm really pleased with this particular invitation, particularly because, as you say, Sean, abortion is a really important feminist issue. But not only that, there is a very concerning counter movement. There's a lot of pressure upon feminist campaigners and on policymakers to reverse any gains made in the area of reproductive health and rights. So I really appreciate this opportunity today to think through a set of ongoing political processes related to women's reproductive health and rights and this neoconservative counter movements. And so this paper is part of a first step, really, in writing a co-authored piece, in first instance for a project that we're doing with the Latin American Bureau and a project called Women's Resistance to Violence, a project led by Kathy McEwen, and for which I'm working with Andrea Espinosa, who's also here now today, to gather data regarding the politics of abortion. And we're trying to think through what does this mean in contemporary Latin America. So that's where we are with this. No, so today is really an exploration of how can we understand what's going on currently. Contemporary campaigns for and against abortion have become a battleground, I think, over sexual morality as a mode of governance. So that's going to be my main argument today, that abortion is a battleground over sexual morality as a mode of governance. Pro-abortion feminist activists define abortion as the right that will allow women to control their own body, fertility, ultimately sexual autonomy, while neoconservative alliances seek a re-envisioning of colonial patriarchal rule, with abortion as one of its main legal pawns. So anti-abortion politics is about sexual morality, it's about heterosexuality, and it's about patriarchal governance. It's about modes of governance that seek to reestablish a tiered hierarchy of citizenship in which some have more bodily autonomy than others. Or it is also not only a reaffirmation of patriarchal governance, but also of colonial struggle structures and hence struggles. So to make this argument, I will first set out the problem, discuss the legal activism of the last so many years, then I will turn to the neoconservative counter movements and its significance, why it matters, what it means, and then I will turn to thinking about who affects this most. Not everyone is equal in this story. So we need to think about that and what does this mean for the governance of population through a prism of gender, sexuality, and indeed race and class. So my main geographical frame is Latin America. So that is what I will refer to. However, I think that what is happening in Latin America is relevant far beyond, and there are similar trends elsewhere ongoing. So it's also useful and necessary to think about how feminist and neoconservative battlegrounds travel across the world through global political trends and transnational movements and authorities, such as the Vatican, for example. Now, the starting point for returning to abortion politics was recently the approval by the Argentinian state on the 30th of December of 2020 of a bill that legalizes abortion in all circumstances after a very long battle that starts in Argentina in the 1980s. And as some of you who follow Latin America closely or who follow the politics of reproductive rights, this victory was indeed celebrated across the continent as a victory for women's rights and equality, as the starting point to a turn towards more progressive and feminist politics. However, unfortunately, after the dust settled, we can see that the turn to the right is still ongoing. And even the populist left is often neoconservative in its sexual mores. We see that currently ongoing in the elections in Peru as well. So various scholars have made the point, of course, of a lack of feminist solidarity among male-dominated left-wing movements since the 1980s, notably Maxine Molyneux in her work. Now, first, a couple of basic numbers to get our head around the problem here. What is the problem of abortion? According to the Guttmacher Institute, one of the main authorities with regard to abortion, as of 2017, more than 24 million women of reproductive age in Latin America and the Caribbean have an unmet need for modern contraception. Yeah, so that is 24 million. This also means that 24 million have difficulty controlling their fertility and hence their own sexual body. Between 2010 and 2014, Latin America and the Caribbean had the highest rate of unintended pregnancy of any world region, 96 per 1,000 women. In the subregion of the Caribbean, the rate was 116 unintended pregnancies per 1,000 women. An estimated 14 million unintended pregnancies occur each year in Latin America, and of these, nearly half end in abortion. So that's about 7 million abortions per year. And a majority or many of those will be in a context of illegality, of criminalization, yeah? And I don't really have numbers of how many of those 7 million abortions end in physical harm to women. I haven't looked for them either. So if anybody knows that such numbers exist, then I'd be keen to hear about it. But we do have information on where the provision of abortion is legal and hence easier and safer to access than elsewhere. And of course, we know that there will be more unintended pregnancies and hence more abortions if there is a lack of access to reproductive health and rights more generally. No, so there is a link, of course, between high levels of abortion and illegality or lack of access. So where is it easier and less easy or illegal to obtain an abortion? In Latin America, the only place where abortion is legal is Cuba, Guyana, Puerto Rico, Uruguay, and now Argentina. Yeah. In other countries where abortion is prohibited altogether, criminalized Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Haiti, Honduras, Nicaragua, Suriname. These countries have no explicit legal exception at all to abortion. Then there's a whole bunch of remaining countries, of course, in between, who will have some exceptions for what is called therapeutic abortion, mostly in cases of risk to a mother's life. Very few countries have also decriminalized abortion in cases of rape. Only Brazil, Bolivia, Colombia, Chile, and some states within Mexico. So the majority is illegal, no? But even in those countries where there is an existence of this basic legal exception of therapeutic abortion, that does not mean that the service is actually accessible, as there might be not be any drugs or infrastructure or professionals actually to execute the process. There's still extensive conscientious objection to abortion within the medical health services. So it doesn't secure women from prosecution either because of those reasons, which is something that we see in the Peruvian context, for example. In countries like Peru, Venezuela, Paraguay, and Guatemala, abortion after rape is still prohibited and punished with prison, ranging from a couple of months to several years. It doesn't necessarily happen everywhere, but it's a threat. Peru even has a special consideration to what is called aborto sentimental, a sentimental abortion, which is an interruption of a pregnancy that is a product of rape out of wedlock. And only out of wedlock. Then in those cases, you get a lower sentence. So it's still not legal, but you might get a lower sentence than if it would be a product of rape within wedlock. In Ecuador, until April 2021, abortions in cases of rape were only permitted for women with a mental disability. So this sounds all very restrictive, no? Is there actually any progress? Well, there actually is. It's slow and arguably minor, but it's important because there tends to be a domino effect, no? Which is why we were also excited about Argentina, no? For one and then another. And the last couple of years, some changes have been made. Mexico City and Oaxaca fully legalized abortion completely, yeah? Ecuador decriminalized abortion in cases of rape only this year. Colombia also decriminalized abortion in cases of rape. That is a law from 2011, and Chile in 2017. So this is only decriminalization in cases of rape. Nevertheless, that seems minor, but it is big because the idea is that lawmakers, feminist lawmakers, are pushing every time a little bit more and sort of bit by bit a push for changes, no? So they're very much the result of very consistent strategic legal activism and feminist policy making within governments and lawmakers. So feminist activism around abortion emerged in the 1980s, of course. And was not initially not very subtle. There is a change if you look at feminist activism in relation to abortion that is very clear of if it's strategic, persuasive, or more feminist activism. And these two images show the difference. Yeah, in the 1980s, the image on the left is from Argentina. No a la maternidad, sí al placer. No to motherhood, but yes to pleasure. And that was at that moment a type of activism, perhaps similar to contemporary Ni Una Menos or Me Too, in the sense that it's very disobedient to social norms. No, it goes against the normative understanding of what gender is and what female sexuality is. In that particular context and time. It was a somewhat riotous activism. It's what Sonia Alvarez calls uncivic activism, an activism that goes against the social norms and perhaps even the gender norms and even legal understandings of those, of that moment. And I think actually, so Ni Una Menos, Me Too is also uncivic, largely because it's about mob justice, no? Because it's about online justice and no legal justice. And that in itself is very riotous, arguably. Now, contemporary campaigning, that is the image on the right, has learned not to make claims based on an idea of bodily autonomy and women's rights, because that seems too easily rejected with arguments around the right to life, which has been for a very long time the main sort of counter argument, no? The right to life of fetuses. And instead, it points at authoritative evidence that shows that comprehensive sexual and reproductive health and rights protects against unwanted pregnancy, abortion, and maternal mortality, no? So abortion and pregnancy is then strategically framed as a health issue rather than a rights issue. And we will see later on that that is also problematic to a certain extent, of course. But it appears to be more palatable perhaps than women's rights, for it allows for stronger arguments against the pro-life lobby, if you wish. This does not mean, of course, that abortion as an issue of women's rights is erased at all. It's just that different persuasive arguments are developed for different audiences. And one of the reasons of some of the recent successes at decriminalization in Ecuador, Colombia, Argentina, and even Chile is because of the alliance between women in politics, healthcare campaigners, and feminist collectives, each speaking to different constituencies, no? And one of the strongly related policy initiatives that is strongly related to abortion and receives, if possible, an equal amount of resistance from counter movement is comprehensive sex education, which is, as you can see on the image on the right, educación sexual para prevenir anticonceptivos, para prevenir aborto legal, para no morir, no? Educación sexual para decidir. So sex education to decide, contraceptives to prevent, and abortion so as not to die. And sex education is the ideal tool to reduce unwanted pregnancies and abortion, but also to create a more equal and respectful society in terms of gender and in intimate relations. And a lot of the sort of the comprehensive sex education that has been developed by professionals over the last 15 years or so in Latin America are very non-discriminatory. They're very pro-sexual diversity and respect for and so on. And that again creates a lot of resistance from the neoconservative counter movement. So from Peru and Ecuador to Mexico, comprehensive sex education has been obstructed and has really generated a lot of protest from counter movements and even from religious parents groups who have successfully taken to the streets to protest sex education and influence conservative politicians. In Peru, conservative resistance to new legislation has actually helped remove two education ministers and indirectly a president between, if I remember well, between 2011 and 2017 or so. So this is a very powerful lobby all about the national curriculum of sex education. Never happened before, I think, in so much resistance. And the arguments, and this is the organization, the image is from the Peruvian neo-conservative counter-movement called Comis Hijos No Te Metas. The arguments against sex education are directed at the familiar idea that talking about sex creates perversions. In previous times, these perversions might have been masturbation and sodomy. Today, the perversion is gender equality and sexual identity. No, unsettling the rigidity of the gender binary is the perversion. No, and contemporary holistic sex and gender education is trying to unsettle those binaries. No, so that is what in part creates so much resistance. But it has also created an oppositional language against gender as an analytical category, as an idea. So hence the headline here, Género Nunca Más, never again gender, no? As if gender itself is something that is evil, no? And it reminds me of the opposition to feminism and how feminism as an, and feminists, have been portrayed as or stigmatized really in a lot of cultural discourses, and these neoconservative organizations are trying to do the same with the term and the terminology around gender. No, they're trying to make it a stigmatizing terminology, while feminists in Latin America very purposefully moved from feminist analysis to gender analysis because it was less stigmatized. No. Although it might not, in practice, not have meant anything different. So as we see here, Never Again Gender, spearheaded or an organization by six men, no, which already indicates that this is about the idea that families headed by men should decide over the sexual mores of their families and their children, no? And hence the con mis hijos no te metes, don't touch my children, which is a slightly ironic sort of play of words that I don't think that they meant as such. But they have these ideas, sort of, these are my children, and hence they're not, they you know, this is a private space. So there's a link here, which I will draw on a little further, which to a neoliberal economy, really, a privatization that is very effective. So opposition to sex education is a morality move that governs the sexual and reproductive lives of young people into very strict gender roles. And this neoconservative opposition further emphasizes that the opposition to abortion is not an argument about the start of life, which is what a lot of what the pro-life movement and they want. I remember a very powerful debate in Congress in Argentina around, you know, with a pro-lifer explaining when life starts. And that's what's often the argument that is used in religious contexts. But that's not what it's about, because if that's what it's about, no, and not about women's lives, but about fetuses' lives, then the rational course of action would be good sex education, surely, and access to contraception, surely, for all young people. And instead, the opposition to abortion and sex education is really an argument about sexual morality as a tool for patriarchal control. Governance through sexual morality is in great part effective because of this privatization of patriarchal rule. The men saying, don't mess with my family, no? So the question is perhaps, why does this neoconservative counter movement against women's rights and LGBTQ, and that makes the direct link, of course, if it's about a gender binary, it's also very clearly an opposition to LGBTQ rights through this opposition against abortion and sex education. And why has it so much traction and why now, no? Now, I call this a counter movement. This is one, I'll stop sharing. I call this a counter movement, first of all, because I feel that it's, wait, are we still? Yeah. Because I feel that it moves against the historical, albeit nonlinear, erosion of the entwinement of religion and the state on the one hand, and a steady move towards more gender equality, including an acceptance of sexual diversity. So it is against an historical development that seems to go another way, towards more gender diversity and sexual diversity. So the neocon movement is a backlash against gains made in terms of women's rights, gender equality, and LGBTQ rights, or gender and sexual diversity more generally. Of course, since the 1990s, there are laws and policies with regard to gender violence. A lot of Latin American countries have quotas for political parties or even for business. Women are full participant in higher education. Several countries have laws to protect LGBTQ persons against discrimination and even legalized same-sex marriage, Argentina, Brazil, Ecuador, and Colombia. So these are very real gains over the last 20 years or so, or 25 years or so, that are now seeing this backlash. And I think there are several things that are coming together. No, the why now? I mean, opposition to abortion has always been there. So it's not, in that sense, it's not new, but something is different in what is going on now. I think that, well, for one, we can, there's a very poor choice of words in pronouncements by the Vatican about the dangers of gender ideology. No, so the whole idea of gender ideology is rooted in pronouncements by the Vatican's, the idea that gender is a threat to a binary and heteronormative understanding of human sexuality as made by God, and thus a threat to the dominance of the patriarchal family. It was first coined, the term gender ideology, in 1998 by the Vatican, then reinforced by Ratzinger in 2004, and again by Pope Francis in 2016. So the Vatican keeps repeating it, you know? So these pronunciations are really fuel on the fire of religious groups, in particular among growing evangelical churches, of course, and civil society organizations in the US and in Latin America who actively campaign against gender ideology. And one of the most visible of such protests, as some of you might be familiar with, was against Judith Butler, who was heckled at a Brazilian airport for propagating gender ideology. And protesters even burned an effigy of her. Now, I must say that this is also very much uncivic protest, of course. Sonia Alvarez with her uncivic protest, I'm not sure if she was actually referring to this kind of conservative protest, but it's interesting that that neoconservative protest is really adopting forms of protests that we know from the other side, from the more progressive sides, no? And it's effective, clearly. So why now, no? Why is there now such political power in these neoconservative standpoints? Well, for one, there seems to be strong alliances between religious groups and political leaders. This is arguably a result of opportunity, as Lee Payne and Arushka de Souza Santos have argued with regard to Brazil, opportunity being an ongoing economic and political crisis, which play in the hands of growing visibility of and support for strict moral codes. And that then has created political space for political alliances that take the defense of the family in one breath with anti-corruption, for example, no? So it becomes about morality. There's also very clear transnational element to these movements. Religious leaders have very strong networks throughout Latin America and indeed in North America as well. According to Stephanie Rousseau, she looked at this in the Peruvian case and found that the Peruvian neoconservative religious movement and its leader, Christian Rosas, was actually educated at a Virginia-based evangelical liberty university. And this leader, who is one of the most important leaders in the Peruvian neoconservative anti-abortion, anti-sex education movement, he maintains strong networks throughout Latin America. So he travels throughout South America to give talk, talks, attend events, and so on. So as we know from social movement theory, of course, international alliances as well as political opportunities are very important elements in the success of social movements. It seems possible that the conservatism of these movements also attracts funds from private sectors. I haven't looked into the financial aspects of this, but there is a clear economic factor involved in the sense that the language and the interests that are involved resemble the interests involved in the privatization of rights. No, comis, hijos no te metas, don't touch my children, this is my family. And the confirmation of patriarchy fits a neoliberal understanding of the world in which rational man can legitimately exploit another's labor without interference of the state. And this economic exploitation is racialized, of course, but it's just as much gendered. Binary gender roles deliver much cheap reproductive labor and social care. So it fits. So while I like to see this movement as a counter movement against the historical development that is ultimately progressive and emancipatory, the institutional and electoral power of this counter movement is very real, of course, as we know with the election of Bolsonaro in Brazil and Trump in the US. Even if Trump is now voted out, that electorate remains, no? So what is at stake? Why is abortion the ultimate battleground for equality and emancipation? And why do we have to resist and fight back? Well, if women cannot control their fertility, they are forced into domestic spaces. This is part of the economic argument, no? They will have much less chance to participate in the labor market or in politics. They will be tending children if they cannot control their own fertility. It turns women into reproductive machines and makes them the property of the household, of children and men, taking away economic independence and thus also increasing vulnerability to violence. A lack of control over fertility implies a lack of control over one's sexual body, and that makes that sexual body vulnerable to abuse. This feeds into patterns, very clear patterns of gender-based violence. The same values that promote neoconservative sexual morality also condones and even facilitates gender-based violence. It condones gender-based violence, for example, by blaming women for rape, including incest and sexual violence against minors more general. There's a very harsh stance towards victims of rape in many, many countries in Latin America, where children are forced to carry babies to term against their will. And that is in itself, of course, a very clear form of violence. Now, the sexual morality that a pro-life stance implies subordinates women in a patriarchal constellation of state and society and erases LGBTQ lives. It makes those lives impossible. And hence it invites also violence against their bodies. No, so it increases, it tends to increase violence against LGBTQ lives. And the sexual morality that is based on a heteropatriarchal family model with reproduction at its center denies and actively oppresses sexual and gender diversity, reducing gender to a male-female biological binary. So I think we need to see the battle for legal abortion as the current frontline of gender equality for women's rights and sexual and gender diversity more broadly, because without access to contraceptives and legal abortion, women will never be released from domestic duties, or in other words, without access to sexual and bodily autonomy, patriarchal roles are difficult to change. So resistance to abortion and sex education is not to protect life, but to protect male privilege. And as Jean Grugel and Pia Rigirozzi argued very recently, reproductive rights is the starting point for women to be considered full citizens beyond motherhood and family, the condition to be being able to fully participate in the labor market and in social and political life. I briefly want to outline what the current resistance to abortion is unleashing in Latin America. Yeah. and I'm sure that some of you have read about this in more generally, but it's important to highlight the extent of the damage that is being done. Unwanted pregnancy and unsafe abortion is currently violently policed in El Salvador and Nicaragua. Women are imprisoned for aborting and some even for miscarrying. This is structural violence against women sponsored by the state. So in that sense, it's not privatization either. It's state violence, no? And this violence policing is not the only structural violence against women's reproductive bodies. There are increasing reports, increasing research, which shows the extent of obstetric violence, no? The abusive treatment by medical staff of pregnant women before, during, and after childbirth. And there's a very particular class and racial element to this. Women treated badly are often racialized and impoverished women. State services, those are the women who attend state services. And state services are often overloaded and staff is not well supported because of that privatization of health and education. So it comes together again. Now, another note to make, despite increased access to contraceptives throughout Latin America, bar abortion, there has been an improvement in access to modern birth control more broadly. But despite this, adolescent pregnancy has hardly decreased. So fertility rates have decreased dramatically across the region, but adolescent fertility has not decreased, no? And this is in great part the result of unmet need, a lack of sex education, and so on. But also, it points to high levels of sexual violence among young people, you know? and high levels of abuse within families as well, which is completely unaddressed. And this matters, of course, it matters. Children and are attended in the health sector, no? So part of this shift of sort of making reproductive health and rights about health rather than rights, emphasizing the health factor rather than the rights factor, means that adolescent mothers and everything around that is recorded as part of a health problem, yeah? But a large part of these very young mothers are actually should be criminal cases. Yeah, if the age of consent is 14 in many countries, then anyone who falls pregnant before 14 are cases of statutory rape. No, but they're never discussed as part of criminal offenses. They're not even noted, not even in the press, as criminal offenses. And we have looked at the pandemic numbers of adolescent pregnancies, which is really quite concerning. The pandemic has exacerbated this, of course. In 2020, 26 children in Peru, only in Peru, 26 children under the age of 10 were recorded to give birth in healthcare settings. Now, under the age of 10, imagine what needs to happen before a girl can actually give birth at that age, meaning that giving birth at that age is very rare, but still it increased threefold in 2020 compared to all previous years. Yeah. Abortion is refused to these children, so they have to live their lives with that emotional, physical, and actual burden of bearing a child conceived through rape. In Peru, again, girls between 11 and 14, so still under the age of consent, 1,155 pregnancies were registered by the healthcare system in 2020. Now, so this is about unintended pregnancy. That's how it's registered by the healthcare service by the Ministry of Health. That's where we got the numbers from, yeah? But that category unintended pregnancy completely blurs the line between health concerns and the recognition of sexual violence against minors, a criminal act, no? In Bolivia, from January to July 2020, almost 20,000 cases of pregnancies in adolescents were registered, 90 pregnancies a day. In the case of girls under 15, Almost 1,000 cases were registered in Bolivia, again as unintended pregnancies and not as rape or incest. At the same time, the authorities, the Ministry of Health, notes that the majority of those cases are actually the result of sexual violence within the family environment, but nothing is being done about that. So the issue of child sexual abuse as a criminal offense is simply not discussed. The discussion is about the legality of abortion or not, you know, with these children carrying the burden. Are all women and girls affected equally by sexual and gender-based violence and abortion politics? No, of course not. Because one of the reasons why legal abortion didn't take center stage in politics as soon as women entered politics in the 1970s in Latin America is because higher educated middle, upper middle class women who enter politics actually have access to abortion and reproductive health care, you know, in Latin America. Again, this is the difference between private and non-private healthcare systems, you know? So where elite women have access to private healthcare, they also have access to abortion, if it's illegal or not, that doesn't really matter. Malartun noted this in her book on Chile already very in the early 2000s, and in her comparative work, which she did with Laura Weldon as well, that women with access to private healthcare do not have a problem generally in accessing reproductive health, including abortion. And so we must think about the politics of abortion and indeed the politics of sexual and reproductive healthcare, that it affects certain people much more than others. And hence that this restrictive patriarchal sexual morality is a mode of governance with particular consequences for the poor and indigenous populations of Latin America. And this brings me, if I still have time, briefly to, do I still have time, Sean? I didn't really, yeah, okay. To briefly, I want to raise briefly the case of forced sterilizations in Peru, because it's contradictory, and at the same time, it confirms my argument, I believe. In the mid-1990s, i.e. after major progressive movements in the world, after the Cairo Conference on Population in 1994, the Beijing Conference on Women in 1995, the Peruvian government under Fujimori implemented a population program with funds from USAID, which saw 300,000 women and some men sterilized under often unhygienic and coercive circumstances. The system ran on quotas demanded from local healthcare workers to sterilize the local population, in particularly in poor and rural areas. So it was, and I've seen the paperwork for ministers, government ministers, who literally defined the program as a policy to reduce poverty. Yeah, that is what it was. It wasn't about reproductive health or rights. It was a program to reduce poverty by reducing the poor population. So the program was halted after much protest and withdrawal of funding and so on. But repeated attempts to actually judicializing the case by prosecuting its architects have failed up till now. And currently this Sunday, there are elections in Peru, and the Peruvian front runner Keiko Fujimori again claims that there was nothing wrong with the program. It was bringing family planning to the poor. No. Now, this is an extreme case. We must believe that it was an extreme case and that it is not, you know, that it's an outlier. But it points at the way in which women's bodies are variably used for the purpose of governance, poverty reduction, reinforcement of patriarchy. And the episode of forced sterilizations of the poor has not generated equal protest from the neoconservative anti-abortion and anti-sex education movement. And that is interesting because that's what it should do, no? If this is about the protection of life, then surely, and sexual morality, then surely this should generate large protest movements from the neoconservative anti-abortion movement, but it doesn't. So these two moral opposites, a politics of mass sterilization versus an anti-abortion pro-life politics, seems to be walking very peacefully hand in hand to produce a patriarchal colonial mode of governance through a politics of perversely oppressive sexual morality, in which indigenous women are either scolded for having children like guinea pigs, which is the phrasing that were used in these programs, for not being able to control their own fertility, and they're also denied the tools that would allow them to do so effectively. The information, the healthcare, and so on. So how can we understand this? Well, Wendy Brown argued that this neoconservative sexual morality, already before this new neocon movement, this was written in her work in early to mid 2000s, that this neoconservative sexual morality must be seen as a mode of governance and citizenship. And following this line of argument, neoconservative anti-genderism in Latin America is very clearly a deliberate politics of oppression and exclusion, using formal politics and legislative intervention via anti-abortion and anti-sex education politics. And considering the racism and classism of these neoconservative politics, its explicit exclusivity, we need to consider this a form of governance as a deliberate reinforcement of a colonial hierarchy through patriarchal body politics. But if this is so, if this is indeed, if there is sort of a colonial hierarchy in this, why would mestizo families, rural families, working class families buy into this and vote for such a politics of oppression? And I believe that it's exactly why governing through sexual morality is so powerful, because the control over bodies and sexuality sells as a policy of neoliberal privacy. Con mis hijos no te metes, no? Meaning my family is my fiefdom for me to rule. So by making the most intimate of human relationship the center of power, the neocons also seem to empower the powerless, or at least its patriarchs. Body politics, or rather a strict intolerant heterosexual morality directed at reproduction, is a highly effective way of governance through societal hierarchies. And as we know of colonial sexual regimes, such moralities also reproduce racial hierarchies and understandings of racial hierarchies. Arguably then, this form of governance through sexual morality draws the marginalized into subaltern citizenship that reproduces gender and racial inequality from the most intimate into the most public. So now we know what the anti-abortion lobby wants and how it mobilizes sexual morality for the racialized patriarchal governance of populations. And I call them neocons. I continue to call them counter movements because that gives me a spark of hope that actually history is going into another way. But at the same time, we need to ask, of course, are they the counter movements, or are the feminists progressive? Are we the counter movement? No. Who are then the uncivic activists in this story? The feminists demanding an expansion of rights and or defending the gains that were made, or the variety of religious lunatics and established religious organizations and opportunistic populists that come in between? I don't know, of course, history will tell us. As a last note, I just wanted to mention that the pandemic is clearly exacerbating a trend that was already ongoing. There was recently an article by Eve Ensler in The Guardian, which says the pandemic, what was the title? Disaster patriarchy, i.e. patriarchy is being reinforced by the pandemic. Now that the pandemic is exacerbating this, definitely, but the trend was already ongoing. The trend, this neoconservative trend, and the desire to reverse the gains made in terms of women's rights, LGBT rights, sexual diversity, gender diversity, is only now, it seems to me, violently coming to the fore in the tremendous rise in intimate partner violence and domestic violence that we see, you know, including sexual abuse of girls in households and possibly boys. That's likely then as well. And while international organizations, feminist activists, researchers, we're all NGOs globally, particularly and locally, working really hard to campaign for more and better services and innovative responses to domestic violence, there really is very little political engagement with this rise in patriarchal oppression. And that is true for neoconservative governments, But it's also quite true for more social democratic countries in Western Europe, considering the level of violence and injustice, there's very little political scandal, really. Too little political scandal about what is going on. It's the pandemic seems to be creating more space for neoconservative governance through sexual morality, a way of bringing in poorer and racialized populations into a subaltern citizenship that re-emphasizes the idea of every patriarch its own fiefdom, reproducing inequality at its very, very basis in people's intimate lives. I'll leave it at that and look forward to your questions. Thank you.